All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate. Here's today's really packed show. At the back end of the show, I'll be sharing a conversation with the director, Andy Chapman, and two of the actors, Noel Arthur and John Chaffin, from a recent production of Nnamdi E. Kelly's gripping adaptation of Native Son, Richard Wright's classic novel. The play is intense, powerful, and timely. It's everything that theater should be, and hopefully you can get it into a city where you live. Before that, we'll be listening to a clip with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, from the film of the talk, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. Now, he's going to be speaking to the question on fighting fascism and making revolution. And opening the show up, we're going to hear an interview I did with journalist Lauren Markham, the author of the book The Faraway Brothers, which has been called an urgent chronicle of contemporary immigration. Just a little while ago, a couple weeks ago, a friend called me and said, I have a book that you have got to read. And I got the book, read it, and immediately I had to actually get the author of this book on my show. And her name is Lauren Markham. She's the author of The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life, which has been called an urgent chronicle of contemporary immigration. It's the story of twin brothers growing up in El Salvador in the wake of the Civil War, being forced to flee as unaccompanied minors and struggling to find a new life in the great American unknown. Yeah, great American unknown. And it's unfortunate when so many people come here putting everything on the line that they do, it becomes the great American known. And we need more people to know what it's all about. Anyway, I was really moved by this book, and I'm really pleased to welcome to the show now Lauren Markham, who is the author of the book. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I have to tell you, as soon as I heard that recommendation and I started reading the book, I just couldn't stop. And it's really...
That means a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's something that really needs to be spoken to today. And especially in this climate that we're looking at, where you're going from everything from the dreamers to, you know, everything else that's happening. And you're looking at what's happening to people and the need for people to both understand it, but understand also... When you understand something or when you recognize something, there's a compulsion that you're faced with, too, about doing something about it. So I wanted you to start off giving people an idea of, well, give them a synopsis of the book, but also what its origins were.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book, many of us might remember the immigration crisis of the summer of 2014, the unaccompanied minor crisis. In the summer of 2014, the population of unaccompanied minors, and these are young people who've crossed into the United States without papers or parents, they're generally apprehended. The vast majority are generally apprehended very close to the border. And in 2014, that number skyrocketed. It had actually been almost doubling for several years, but in 2014, the government's sort of ability to house and feed and clothe and just kind of give very basic services to these young people was just overwhelmed. They should have known that the numbers would keep rising because they had been, but they didn't. They didn't prepare. So many of us might remember the kind of media blitz of that summer. And I had been writing about unaccompanied minors for a couple of years, kind of with this question of what happened, who are these young people? Why are they leaving? You know, anytime all of a sudden one particular demographic or a few, you know, in this case, young people from Central America start moving, like, we have to ask why. Why are these people moving? What are they leaving? Why are they coming to the U.S.? Why so many of them? I had these questions, and they felt very urgent to me, and nothing I read sort of satisfied the answers I was looking for. And so I began interviewing young people and began writing about them for about this population and this changing dynamic for a couple of magazines. And then I decided that I was sort of never satisfied again. I kept wanting to write more and learn more, and so I decided to write a book. And so the book actually follows the story of two particular unaccompanied minors. The book is called The Faraway Brothers because in El Salvador, the euphemism for someone who's migrated away is hermano lejano or a faraway brother. So the particular faraway brothers I write about are Ernesto and Raul Flores. They come from a rural town in El Salvador, and they, like many unaccompanied minors, sort of end up on the wrong side of the gangs that have been rising in control and in brutality in the post-Civil War years in El Salvador, and they've gotten particularly bad. And the rise in gang violence tracks pretty much exactly with the rise in young people fleeing the country.
Now, tell me this, because one of the things, when you talk about this, this is a big shift. I mean, the migration from the South that's been going on for a long time. But mm-hmm. early on in your book, you do point to exactly what you're saying. There's been a significant change in the character of this. Now, what's happening exactly with the older skilled people? What's leading to that change? What actually led to that change where you have the older skilled people who are,
either just desperately trying to eke out a continued existence there, or for a lot of them, just going home and not going back.
Yeah, well, so it used to be that the most common profile of migration of people coming into the United States from Central America and from Mexico, letting aside sort of in the post-war, after the 80s, in the 80s, hundreds of thousands of people were coming here because there was a war going on, and a war that, by the way, in El Salvador, the United States was funding and supporting the government forces against the leftist guerrillas and government forces that perpetrated mass atrocities. So it used to be that the people who migrated for sort of economic reasons were economic migrants. They were coming to the United States. It was generally the father or the mother who was coming of a family, younger adults, but adults generally who had kids, who would come to the United States, get jobs, and send money home. In 2008 and around 2008 and after, with the economic crash in the United States, the number of adults crossing unauthorized into the United States began dropping, and significantly so. And around 2011, the number of young people started growing. So there was a historical average of around 7,000 unaccompanied minors who were apprehended each year before 2011. This past year, there were 40,000 at the height, which was a couple of years ago. There were about 60,000 who crossed. So the profile really is changing. People aren't coming here for financial reasons anymore as much, although, of course, people still come to the United States for financial reasons. The main driver of the Central American exodus right now is violence. And young people are the ones who are recruited into the gangs. The vast majority of deaths and murders in the Central America's Northern Triangle, which is a region that includes Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, the vast majority of murders are young people. So young people are really at the front lines of this very strange and unconventional war, which is kind of a war between gangs and between gangs and the government.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more, because this is something I was really intrigued by. And I mean, it's horrifying what's happening. And when you look at this thing of actually the gangs that form up in the, you know, gangs were not always the sort of the dominant force in these various countries, whether it's in El Salvador or anywhere else. They weren't always the dominant force in terms of determining what's happening inside the society and what's going to happen in relation to, you know, people leaving or staying. What you're talking about is a very significant change that these gangs have come into it. And in some ways, I mean, even when I was reading your book, I kept thinking, okay, what's the relationship between the gangs and the army and what's going on here? And, you know, and you're actually looking at a whole new, where at one point in El Salvador, you were looking at this vicious regime, and then you're looking at the army coming in. And now, you know, from what you're saying, it's a lot like a lot of this is being taken up by these youth who were recruited as gang members and then actually became, this is how they make their living, and this is how they support their families. And this is sort of the way you do things now.
Yeah, or it is an increasing force. And these gangs have grown in the wake of a brutal civil war. So you have generations of people who are deeply traumatized. It should be noted, and this is an oft-repeated fact, but at the same time, as much as I see it talked about, and as much as I talk about it, it's always surprising to me how few people know this. But MS-13, this gang that is one of the main gangs in El Salvador, it's a gang that Trump and Sessions used to like to talk a lot about to sort of instrumentalize kind of hate and fear against immigrants. And there's sort of these accusations that these young people are bringing MS-13 into the United States, which is the vast majority of young people are fleeing these very same gangs. So in any case, MS-13 was born in Los Angeles during the Civil War among young Salvadorans who had, either without papers or some availing themselves of papers, come into the United States and were living in sort of poor urban neighborhoods and modeled their gangs after pre-existing gangs in the United States. And once those people were jailed and then sent back to El Salvador, they brought MS-13 with them. So the gang violence is actually an import of the United States. You know, that was like in the 90s when these gang members started being deported back, kind of post-war El Salvador. But they're really rising and growing in power in the context of a post-war society that has very limited economic opportunities. They're currently in a country of 6 million. There are 300,000 young people who are not in school and out of work. The vast majority of young people don't go past the sixth grade. There aren't a lot of job opportunities for young people. And so there's this sort of repeated cycle of violence and of trauma coupled with the fact that the government is not providing the basic needs and services, right, that people want and need, like education and healthcare and jobs. So this is this sort of shadow economy that has become one of the dominant drivers in Salvadoran kind of politics and in the economy. And I should say that a lot of people do join gangs in order to, like you said, a lot of young people do join for economic reasons and to be able to support their families, to support themselves. They also join out of, like, sometimes by force. They're told that if they don't join, they'll be killed or their mother will be raped. And sometimes they join for a sense of belonging. They might not have a family. But it's not like sometimes we have the idea of these gangsters being these sort of like flashy high rollers. And the reality is most gangsters, even the high level ones in El Salvador, are not living the high life. The living that they're eking out is still just scraping by. We're talking like a couple dollars a day.
Now, tell me this. One of the things that comes across very hard in your book is that a lot of people, a lot of these youth come looking for some way, like urged to go by their family. They go to save the lives of their family, to make some money, to try and make some money to do this, to, you know, to get away from all this. And they bust in there and they find themselves once again, sort of like what happens when you get to the States. It's not a very good picture if you actually even manage to get there, because the scenes that you paint along the way of the how hard it is for these youth to actually get to where, you know, whatever city they're going to try and get to once they just right. even cross the border, it's phenomenal. And it's mind-blowing what they have to go through.
Yeah, absolutely. The journey itself is horrifying. And that's why, you know, it's important to remember that. It's important to remember how horrifying the journey is, because this is not a decision that's taken lightly, right? Like, you were very, 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 like, let's not mince words here. You are risking your life to make this journey to try to get to the United States. And Raul and Ernesto, who I write about, both kind of experience horrific things along the way. And I should say that they're, and this is true of their story in general, it's like by far by a long shot, the sort of worst or most horrifying story I've heard. In a way, theirs is more tame than many others that I've heard. So the journey is really horrifying. And yeah, you know, there's the American dream looms large around the world, this idea of what's possible when you get here. And then you sort of encounter the reality, which is that, yeah, sure, if you live in Oakland, you can make 12 bucks an hour, which sounds like a fortune in El Salvador, but your rent's $500 a month and your bus fare, and it ends up being a lot more difficult to just scrape by living as a poor person in the United States, as many of us who already live here know, right? Mm-hmm. So that's facing the reality of what it is to be poor in America is a really hard sort of second journey for the migrants. And I think for migrant youth, too, who haven't necessarily ever been in charge of money or had to sort of take care of themselves in the way that adults might have.
Yeah. You know, there's something else I keep thinking as you're talking. I keep thinking about the bike story in your book. And it was so beautifully written. And so it was so powerful because, you know, you remember when you were a kid and the importance of a bike and the freedom that that represented and the way that you could just like, and the way they had these three kids piled on a bike and soaring through their town or wherever they were. And then at the same time, coming up flat, right up against reality in the form of their father. And it really kind of captured a contradiction, I thought. Here you have this, like, this exuberance of youth alive in the world and then the realities of what is happening all around them and the realities that force even their father to become pretty much a hard-nosed jerk a lot of times.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so glad that that scene stuck out to you, because that's one of my favorite stories that they told me. And, you know, the story is essentially they finagle through sort of back-channel means and through not necessarily above-board decisions, which I won't give away, to procure this bike. And, yeah, it means the world to them. But it's also, right, a hint of sort of that desire for things and for a better life, right? And this idea that, right, in the United States, well, you could just get a bike, no problem. Or, you know, you'll make $12 an hour. You'll be able to send money home and get all this fancy stuff. You know, so there is like a sort of the undertone of like this capitalism acquiring of things that is really real, right? For people who are growing up in a state of lack and who also are sold this notion and told this notion that the North, El Norte, it's like this gilded place far away that some people get to go. And the vast majority of Salvadorans have a family member, whether it's a brother or a mother or a cousin, have somebody in their in their sort of extended families, if not many people, who live in the United States. So there's like it's like almost fundamentally biologically connected, the United States and El Salvador. And so everyone has this picture in their mind of what the United States is like.
Yeah, and it's important. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that clash of myth and reality there, because it is true. You have this mythic North, and then on the one hand, it doesn't really exist for the immigrants coming. And at the same time, another version of that mythic North depends on the immigrants coming for its very functioning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a raw deal.
Yeah.
It's kind of a raw deal for the migrants. Yeah. The myth of the American dream is something we tell those of us who are born in the United States, and those of us maybe who've never left the United States or who have, or sell ourselves this idea that we're the best all the time, right? And I think, and actually I think a lot of atrophying can and does happen from that place of internally, like our own bolstering, self-bolstering that the American dream is alive and well. And if it weren't for this person or that person, I would have my slice of the American, you know, the American dream pie or whatever. But it's definitely something, I mean, you know, I've written about migrants coming from all over the world, and it's, this idea of the United States and what's possible is just, it's pervasive. And then having interviewed and worked with so many migrants who've made their way to the United States and become immigrants, it's so rare that the dream matches up with the reality. It's also interesting, though, because, and this is something that the sister ended up being surprising to me. I wasn't expecting to write so much about her, the twin sister who stays at home. And she taught me a lot about so many things. But one of the things that was really interesting to me is that she would say things like, I know it's not like all milk and honey up there. You know, I know life is hard. I know that we don't understand how hard life is. Like, I know that. I know I can't imagine how hard it is. And at the same time, she's like, but I know that if I go, I could make it, right? Like, if I go, the dream would be possible for me. So she kind of held both the reality and the dream at the same time, which I thought was fascinating, right? Because it shows actually the power of myth and dreams, that it's just sort of, you're like, okay, well, even if all of the evidence tells me that the myth is not true, and I know that sort of intellectually, still somewhere in my belly and in my gut, you know, is this swirling dream? And I think that that's really interesting and telling.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I'm looking at the clock, and I think I have about time for two more questions, so I'm going to have to winnow them down.
I'll be faster in answering them.
No. Take your time. We'll go right up to the end, okay? One of them is this, and this is another one of these, like the bike story. This also stood out to me, and you talk about a corridor that allows safe passage for animals along the border.
Yeah, I know.
And yet, when it comes to humans, there is no safe passage, and oftentimes there's death.
Yep, exactly. So it's this park in... And that was actually a section that had come out of the first article I ever wrote about unaccompanied minors. But there's a park in southern Texas along the Rio Grande, in the Rio Grande Valley, called the Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge. And this is a zone of Texas where, you know, much of this part of Texas, there is a border fence. And so sort of me, California girl, 6 years ago, I was sort of driving along the border being like, what's this giant fence? And it's like, oh, yeah, that's the border fence. But in Santa Ana, because it's a national wildlife refuge, or I'm sorry, it's not a national, I think it's a state wildlife refuge, because they were sort of reviving, it was sort of restored wetlands, all of these animal rights activists and sort of naturalist environmental activists got together and said, the fence must stop on either side of the national wildlife, you know, we have to stop, because otherwise you're going to have animals like the ocelot and the this and the that who can't get across and who are stuck, and it's very dangerous for them. So yeah, so that is now open explicitly for animals. And it just shows, I think, too, like the unnaturalness of a physical border barrier, because the thing to me, no matter how many borders I've visited, it's a fair number, it's just always so bizarre to me that it looks just exactly the same on one side as the other. It sounds so silly, but it's wild, right? Like it looks the same because it is the same. It's actually a fictitious designation, right? We've made it up. We've decided on this side that's that, and on this side that's that. But to animals, it's irrelevant, right? And humans are animals.
Yeah, yeah. All right, now we have about maybe 6 minutes to answer this one, okay? I want to talk about this, the root of the problem again. Why is, you know, look, you look at it, the root of the problem, it's dealing with why is Central America hemorrhaging people, as the way you put it in a book, which I thought was a very powerful way to put it, and the role of the U.S. in all this. You know, Bush, Obama, Trump, all of these people have played a role in basically the pillaging or forcing the pillaging of the populations of those three countries in particular, but also just throughout the world. But in relation to this, let's talk about the role of the U.S. in all of this and what's happening there.
Yeah, great question. I mean, so there's the legacy of war, which is just that, like, our Vietnam vets are still a big part of, you know, like the trauma of Vietnam is still alive and well in the United States. And that was a war that was not fought on here, right? Like in our home country. So the legacy of war is deep and long in El Salvador, and the United States contributed greatly to that, to those atrocities. Of course, like the immigration policies that we have very much take advantage of migrants. And there are many industries, like where I live in California, the agricultural industry that feeds a good part of this country relies on undocumented workers and very hard workers at that. So there's all sorts of like foreign policy decisions, past and present, that we've made and are making that continue to exploit Central Americans. I mean, I think to me the biggest issue is that we think we can litigate immigration at the border. We actually think of immigration as a border issue. And to me, it's like what happens in a lot of sort of foreign policy, or our conception of problems and how to deal with them, is that we don't consider the source. So we think of immigration as what happens when someone steps across that bright red line. And then that's where, you know, we have to be at that bright red line and bring drones and bring, you know, retinal scans and bring helicopters and bring border patrol people and build fences, which is all those things we're doing. But why are people coming? That's not the question we're asking. We're saying, how do we stop them from coming? It doesn't work, right? Like, that's where people figure out how to get over walls or under walls or around. Like we know this to be true. For time immemorial at borders, people figure out how to cross them, especially desperate people. So I think the largest issue to me is how little we're looking at what's happening in these countries, and particularly in El Salvador, I can speak to because I've spent so much time there, that we're not looking at what the root causes is, the gang issues and the economic challenges there. And we could be doing a lot more to invest in supporting alternative opportunities there than like doing all that work at our border that isn't going to do anything besides further criminalize immigrants, push immigrants into harsh territory where they're more likely to die as they're trying to cross here. So I think it's really an issue of perspective. Like, are we focusing on the border? Or are we focusing on what brings people here?
And if you look at it too, though, I mean, it's also true that, yes, that's true, but it's also true that, look, for a long time, the U.S. and what it encouraging people to come up from Central America, from Mexico, these kinds of things where people were seen as the source of cheap labor and great profits
Absolutely.
For the U.S. industry. And,
Absolutely.
You know, and that's something very important for people to consider because, look, people migrate for survival. They don't migrate because they just get tired of the place they're living in. They migrate for survival. And then they come into this culture and their way of life and culture is smashed. And they come to this culture, which is all about serve the system, make, you know, for the U.S., it's like, how are they going to get the highest rate, both security-wise and profit-wise, in terms of what they're doing? And for a lot of these youth today, it involves the drudge jobs, you know, because of this is what's happening to the U.S. economy.
And those are the jobs you can get without papers, right?
Right, yeah.
Or with sort of insecure papers, so.
Anything else you'd like to add right before we go?
No, just want to thank you so much for this. I mean, I think, again, immigration is a hot topic of today, and it's also just an important issue that the United States has had to reckon with and needs to reckon with more of. And so, again, this kind of urging to think about what the root causes are. And again, getting out of the paradigm of pull factors, that people are being pulled to the United States. That's true, but that's not the whole story. The vast majority of these young people coming from Central America are being pushed out, and the United States is the place that they're going. But they're leaving because of what's happening on the ground, not because of the promise of what's going to happen here.
And the U.S. pillaging of their countries has a lot to do with what's happening on the ground these days.
Yes,
so.
Absolutely.
Very important.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much, Lauren. Really a pleasure talking
Thanks
with
so
you.
Thanks so
much. Sure.
All right. That was Lauren Markham, author of the book The Faraway Brothers. And remember, you will find the names of all the books, films, and articles that I mentioned on this show on my Facebook page. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Right, that was Santana with Migra. And now we're going to hear Bob Avakian from the film of the talk, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. And Avakian speaking to a question on fighting fascism and making revolution.
You touched on this in your talk earlier, but they asked the question, can you talk about the difference and similarity between the situation we face in driving out the Trump-Pence regime and a situation that would be more open to and possible for revolution? Can one lead to the other? And what should revolutionaries do in the face of this?
Well, okay, I talked about, you know, what needs to happen beginning on November 4th, you know, in terms of what refused fascism is called for, you know, an outpouring that begins with thousands and is sustained day, as they put it, day after day, night after night, and grows into millions. And the objective of that is not, it is not a, you know, I noticed that some of these fascists online have said that people are talking about, you know, that this November 4th is a call for a civil war or a call for a violent, you know, attack on the government. That is completely untrue. What is being called for is not a violent uprising against the system. And what is being called for is massive but nonviolent, sustained, you know, movement of people, which is determined to create a political crisis and a political situation which leads in one way or another to the Trump-Pence regime being forced out of power, not through violent means. Okay, that's just to be absolutely clear. And that's, but that still is a question of millions of people getting involved. A revolution does mean, you know, first of all, a revolution requires certain things that do not exist at this time. And, you know, I'll get to whether or not they could emerge out of the driving out the regime. But it requires a revolutionary crisis in society where, you know, the divisions that exist within the ruling structures and forces are intensified. And, you know, when they attempt to repress the people who are rising up, the repression only leads to more people getting involved in rising up against the powers that be. And you know, it requires that kind of a crisis where people refuse to live under the system as they generally have accepted living. Let's face it. I mean, I talked about Harriet Tubman. You know, even slaves tried to find a way to live within slavery because they had to. You know, there were actually several hundred slave insurrections, which you don't learn much about it in school here, but there were uprisings of slaves, and you know, Nat Turner, and uprising in New Orleans, and you know, Denmark Vesey. There were rebellions of slaves, but most of the time, the slaves put up with their, you know, condition not because it wasn't horrific, but because they had to live. You know, they had to try to find a way to exist under this. You know, and the reason I'm saying that is most of the time, most people, even those really oppressed under the system, put up with living under the system because they don't see a way out. And those, you know, and the way out that's offered is either an illusion or worse, or it doesn't seem realistic to them at a given time. And, you know, a revolutionary situation is brought about by a combination of all the work that's done by revolutionaries building toward it and what's happening in the larger world in terms of how the contradictions of the system and contradictions between different forces within the country and internationally are affecting things and lead to the kind of crisis I was talking about, where it can be different kind of crisis. It doesn't have to be a deep economic crisis where everybody's unemployed or half the population is unemployed. It could be a political crisis. It could be a social crisis. It's just a crisis where, on the one hand, people feel that they don't have to and don't want to, but don't have to live under the system any longer, and where the ruling powers are not able to rule in the way that they've usually ruled and are at each other, and also, you know, finding that their attempts to repress the people are not succeeding, but only calling forth more outpouring from the people. For example, even though the revolution in Iran ended up in a bad place with Islamic fundamentalists coming to power, there was a tremendous mass upsurge against the Shah that began in 1978. And at a high point of that mass uprising throughout that country, in one day, the army of the Shah killed 10,000 people. Now, in a lot of situations, that would have been the end of that. That would have put an end in the short term to that uprising. But because things had reached such a point, that actual mass slaughter only called forth millions more people to become more determined to bring down the rule of the Shah. Now, unfortunately, that didn't end up in a good place. But that's the kind of thing that happens when you get to right to the precipice of the ledge of a leap into a revolutionary situation. So that's one of the key ingredients. And then what goes along with that, you have to have a people, a revolutionary people in the millions and millions who are determined that they will not live under this whole system anymore and are willing to put everything on the line for that. Those are, you know, conditions that revolutionaries work toward, but there's also what's happening in the larger world that that brings about much of the changes that can ultimately lead to that. And that's a very different thing than what we're talking about in terms of November 4th and driving out this regime. In an actual revolution, which is different than what's being called for, I want to emphasize again on November 4th and what's being built out of November 4th, in an actual revolution, people do have to go up against, I mean, look what I was talking about in Iran. The people who rule this country, for example, they believe that their system is the best possible system and any other system is an abomination that will lead to disaster. They firmly believe this. And they have gotten where they've gotten by crushing any attempt to go up against, go up against them in any kind of fundamental way. So when it comes to it, they're not gonna say, oh, we didn't realize that people were suffering so terribly. We didn't realize that women were being put through these horrors every day. We didn't realize what was happening to LGBT people. We didn't realize that there were a lot of poverty in the world that we were profiting from. We didn't realize what black people and immigrants and other Latinos are being put through. We didn't know about these police murders. We thought they were all justified. We didn't really know they weren't. Oh, okay, now we understand, so we'll just step aside. No, they're going to try to drown in blood any attempt at going up against their whole system to get rid of it. And when it comes to it, people are going to have to meet and defeat that. If you are living in a house that's ruled by a tyrant who beats everybody, you know, especially anybody that gets out of line, if you want to rectify that situation, you have to break the hold of that tyrant over that household. If you're living in a system that rules in the way this system does, that lives by exploiting people and oppressing people and bringing down force against those who pose any serious challenge against it. When it comes to that revolutionary situation, and not a handful or a few thousand even, but millions and billions of people have come to the point where they will not live under this system any longer, then you have to organize yourself in such a way that you can actually defeat and dismantle this armed force that comes down against you. That's what a revolution is. That's what a revolution will require when it comes to it. We're not there at this point. The point of drive out the Trump-Pence regime is not that's what's being aimed for. Now, this goes back, it's that what's being aimed for is different in the way I talked about it. We, you know, as I said earlier, a revolution is a very serious thing. It has to be, all of this is very serious, but a revolution, above all, is extremely serious and has to be approached very seriously and very scientifically. Constantly analyzing where you are in relation to that goal and what are the contradictions that you have to fight through and what is happening in the larger world and among, you know, what are the divisions among the ruling powers? What's happening internationally? How is that affecting things within the country? All these kind of things have to be continually analyzed because, first of all, you have to have a scientific method to analyze them, and second of all, they keep changing. Life does not stand still. I mean, again, I go back to who the hell expected Trump to be president, okay? That's a big change, you know, and it's not something, you know, some people said to us right after the election, oh, you guys must be really happy now because now that you got Trump in there, a lot of people are going to feel like resisting. No. This is a terrible situation, and it could get even much worse. But it is a big change that you have to deal with. And life and, you know, society and the world are constantly changing. So you have to approach this very, very seriously and scientifically in order to get to the point where you can actually have a revolution. Because in the final analysis, and let me emphasize that phrase, in the final analysis, you cannot resolve all these things that put massive people through horror within this system. Only by a revolution can that be done. That's why we need a revolution, not because, you know, somebody somewhere, you know, when I was 22, I read a book about revolution and it sounded exciting, so now we need a revolution. No. I mean, I have read about revolutions that are exciting, but the need for revolution doesn't arise out of that. It arises out of the actual conditions of the masses of humanity and the contradictions that are built into the system that mean that these horrors will continually be perpetrated and perpetuated on masses of people. So that's on a revolution. Now, in terms of the relationship between the one and the other, between the immediate and urgent goal of driving out this regime and the question of revolution, I've said that our analysis is that the process of revolution at this point has to go through driving out the Trump-Pence regime. But that doesn't mean it's the same thing as a revolution. The revolution is a completely different thing in the way that I talked about. It's on a whole other level. And it does require different means, and that's not what's immediately before us. Now, obviously, if you see, you know, there's a need for revolution, like we have what we call the five stops. Stop, you know, I'm going to just briefly summarize, characterize them. You know, stop the persecution and oppression of black, brown, Native American people. Stop the destruction of the environment by the imperialist system. Stop the hounding and terrorizing of the immigrants. Stop the degradation of women and the enforcing of traditional gender relations and the discrimination and oppression against LGBT people. Stop wars of empire and crimes against humanity. We didn't come up with these five stops because, well, let's think of something clever that, you know, oh, I know, stops. You know, let's stops, that's a good thing. What's a good number? Oh, five, okay. No, we analyzed things and said these are the profound contradictions that people that are having, you know, horrendous effects on people throughout the world, and they need to be stopped. But we also made the analysis, and we're not trying to trick anybody, that people need to fight against these things now because they're intolerable. But ultimately, they can't be stopped. They can't be eliminated, other than through getting rid of this system. And, you know, I made the challenge. If anybody wants to argue against our position on the need for revolution, tell us either that these five stops are trivial and unimportant, and I'd like to hear that argument, or tell us how you're going to get rid of these things and put a stop to these things under the present system, and I'd like to hear that argument too. Because I don't believe you can do it. First of all, I believe they're incredibly important, and second of all, I don't believe you can do that within this system, and you can do it within the framework of a radically different system, which is laid out in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America. So that's why we see the need for a revolution, and we're working scientifically toward that revolution and to win masses of people to see the need for that revolution and to themselves become leaders of that revolution by taking up the science that's necessary to do that and the method. But look, this goes back to an earlier question. What will come out of this? I honestly don't know. There are a lot of different things that could happen. Is it possible that through the whole swirl of this, a revolutionary situation could emerge? Yes, it's possible. If you ask me to sit here now and tell you, is it likely? Well, I don't like to engage in unscientific speculation, but if you twist my arm, I'll say probably not. But we don't know. And I'm certainly not going to rule out the possibility, but that's not the aim of what refused fascism is called for November 4th and building from there to drive out this fascist regime. And, we will continue working toward revolution for all the reasons that I've said, of why we think it's necessary and why we think it's emancipating. But our goal now, immediate political goal, is to join with many, many others, most of whom do not agree with us at this point about the need for revolution, to achieve the driving out of this regime for all the reasons that I've spoken to, and then we'll see. We'll see what that leads to, and we'll continue to fight for a positive outcome to that even shorter revolution, even as we continue on a more fundamental level to continue working for the revolution that we're firmly convinced is scientifically established as a necessity and as a liberating alternative to the world we live under now.
That was Bob Avakian from the film of the talk, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. And he was speaking on fighting fascism and making revolution. And if you want to get the entire talk, you can find it at revcom.us. Now, let's go right into my conversation with the director Andy Chapman and two of the actors Noelle Arthur and John Chaffin from a recent production of Nnamdi E. Kelly's gripping adaptation of Native Son, Richard Wright's classic novel.
What we're talking about here is a production of Native Son, and I'm really pleased to welcome to the show some people from the play, okay? First off, Andy Chapman, the director. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure. And actors Noel Arthur and John Chaffin. Noel, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for having us.
Yeah, John, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure. All right, Andy, you first.
Yes. Oh, my.
It's easy. Come on. You just got to just give people a synopsis of the play so we can all be on the same framework.
The play is based on Richard Wright's novel, wonderful novel, Native Son, about Bigger Thomas and the Thomas family and young man who inadvertently kills a white woman and how his life unravels from there.
The thing is, it's not the first staging, but it's certainly a different staging.
Right. Yeah. She's had 8 productions done. We're the, I think, 9th or maybe the 8th. I'm not certain.
Mm-hmm. But even in terms of the play itself, I mean, there was a play that Orson Welles was involved in way back when the book was coming out. And it's a very different dramatic setup that's going on.
Yeah. She uses W.E.B. Du Bois's Souls of Black Folk, the double consciousness, to tell the story. So not only do we meet Bigger Thomas, we meet his mindset, his double consciousness, and it takes the form of the black rat. And we get inside of his mind, so we understand his thinking in that particular moment and how it continues from there.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's jump into this with John and Noel. Let's see which, John, you can go first since Noel went first. Anyway, let's talk about this. This play is very different from
very
the book.
Very different.
And from earlier plays. And when you talked about the rat, I was fascinated with the rat, okay? And in particular, the way that this is brought out, you have the rat, and you have the killing of the rat, of the rat, and then you have the rat who's actually, you know, an alter ego in a certain sense. And I wanted to ask you about this. Explain the rats and what the significance of this play is to you.
Well, to me, like Andy said, is based off of the double consciousness that W.D. Du Bois talked about, as far as seeing yourself how other people see you and not how you see yourself. So the rat is sort of, it represents how I'm seen or how people see Bigger, how the world sees Bigger. But when I look into the mirror and I see myself, this is how I want to be. You know, I see myself as bigger than or more than. So for me, the significance of this story is just like what Andy told us, this is like a love story to the black man.
Yeah.
And for me to be able to jump inside the shoes of Bigger and to find the connection between myself and him and to be able to, as me, John, be able to see myself as bigger than and to see myself not as the world sees me or not to be perceived as how I want to be looked at, but how I truly feel for myself and to be fulfilled inside. And I think that's what Bigger wants. And Richard Wright spoke about there's not just one type of Bigger Thomas. There's many types of Bigger Thomases. So what we were trying to do, and I think what Nnamdi is trying to do with this, is to show that empathy is at the root of everything and to get inside the mind and the heart to see why this man does what he does and the circumstances that gave birth to his choices.
Mm-hmm. Now, Noel, your character, for instance, is something that's really unique, I think, in terms of, I mean, people have been talking about this double consciousness, and that was something that Du Bois came up with, and in terms of what's happening with black people in their lives in the world, right? And the fact that there's a dichotomy that goes on. It's a unity, but it's also, people have to be one thing one place and one thing another place, and that has to be constantly going on in people's lives, and especially for young black men, and for black men altogether.
Right.
And it's not just the South, folks. It's anything south of Canada. And even then, you know, you're going. So there is a point here about the question of what's going on with this. And I wanted to talk with you about it, Noah, because you play the rat, okay? Not a lovable character. I mean, in the play it is. I'm just, you know, people think a rat. But you play the rat. It is that double consciousness. And it is that sort of digging around. And how do you, and there's a constant, it's almost like Bigger couldn't survive without you. And you certainly wouldn't be able to survive without him. You
know? Right. Well, I guess the first thing I would say is, speaking on that survival part, in terms of an updated version of what I would say is the double consciousness philosophy, is the term that people use these days is called code switching. You know, to survive in our modern society, you know, my friends joke about it. When we're in black company, we speak a certain way, we act a certain way. But when you're in an overarching white society, as reduced in overt racism as it is, we still have to kind of play the game or read the terrain in a certain way to survive, to get ahead. Mm. Be it in the 30s or the current era, what's great about this character is that Andy was saying is that you see the thought process of how this happens and kind of explain some of the choices that my other half, Bigger, does. He doesn't have a lot of resources and he acts a certain way. My character kind of shows you how he navigates the terrain to survive, you know, literally survive, not just career-wise or whatever, but literally to survive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I was going to say, he's not his alter ego. He is his double consciousness, meaning that he is Bigger Thomas. So alter ego means something different as opposed to who the Black Rat and Bigger Thomas are to each other.
Yeah, it took quite a while. Like, actually, I think we're still continuing to figure out this kind of concept that we're the same person. It's almost like the Trinity, you know, like
one apple,
you know,
peeling.
Exactly. The same person, but different aspects. You know?
Right.
Yeah. Not alter ego, but same person, different aspects.
Yeah.
And that's important. I mean, look, your character, like I was saying, it's completely new. You don't see a lot of this going on anywhere in relation to this. And it does flow from this double consciousness. Now, I want to talk about a little bit more about your character in relation to John's character.
Okay. You
know? And the fact that, yes, they're the same. It makes it really intriguing. And really, you're sitting there, you're watching it, and you're thinking, okay, there's a back and forth. And I have to tell you, for a little while, I was thinking, damn, I wish I had somebody on the other side. Don't be so stupid. You know, the thing is we're laughing about a lot of this stuff, but it's actually, you know, sometimes you laugh to keep from crying, but it's not really crying. It's enraging what actually was captured by this play. It's just an incredible, incredible piece. And Andy, you talk about some poetry you have. I want you to just actually talk to people about in a minute into relation to this play and in relation to the book itself. And when Richard Wright wrote this, it was sort of like, wow, this was not an easy thing to get over. And now we're talking about what you guys are doing. And in terms of this, I want to talk about your relation to Bigger a little bit more.
Sure. Well, I'll speak from the perspective of me personally getting into this play. About 3 years ago, I got wrongfully arrested. I was wearing another suit. I got wrongfully arrested. I went back to New York to one of my best friend's wedding from high school. For 20 hours, I was in the penal system in a suit. Sometimes I was in 30 people's cells. And, you know, there were people who were going back to long-term sentences. And I sat there and I just thought about how quickly my situation had changed. And there was a moment where I got transferred from the precinct to central booking. And there were two cops who came on duty and they were looking at me and they were like, what is this person doing here? And they actually asked me that. And I had a moment where the anger inside of me was about to well up and I was just going to curse them out. But something inside of me went, no. You know, be smart. And I smiled and I said what I had to say, and they actually coached me through how to survive jail. So I thank those cops, but also it was because I made the decision in my head to go down the right path. And for me, that is why I had wanted to play the Black Rat. I didn't have a lot of thoughts like that before. Mm-hmm. You know, it was usually about the rage. And when I saw the inkling of what is possible with a higher thought process, I wanted to continue exploring that. So I had done about 3 plays since that arrest where I played a frustrated, angry Black man. And the attraction for me was to do something where I had an elevated consciousness, an elevated version. And every night I go on stage, I'm still exploring this character. Technically, we know where the map of what I should be doing for Bigger is helping him through surviving this play, surviving the murders and the violations he does. But internally, it is actually kind of cathartic for me. It is my therapy of really trying to attain the thoughts, the pure thoughts of the Black Rat. Being this guide to what I feel John's character Bigger is, of just a frustrated black man that we see so much in this country that gets these stigmas imposed on us because of the color of our skin, for no other reason because of that, born into it.
Yeah.
But I guess, as our playwright Nambi has said, this is a love letter to black men where, without looking for salvation outside of yourself, everything is within.
Yes.
And so that is my continual curiosity as I play the Black Rat. How do I, as we perform, continue to uplift myself, my other part of myself?
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with director Andy Chapman and actors Noelle Arthur and John Chaffin from Native Son. That's the name of the play, yes, and it's Richard Wright's book, because that's one of the things that really hits you is the fact that in time you're going different spaces and different, suddenly the woman supposed to be dead is out, like, is talking and riding in the car with you and doing all this. But, you know, when you were talking about there's these decisions that people make, Bob Avakian actually made a point. I was reading this morning, because people talk about, well, you had a choice. You had a damn choice. Come on. You know, that's
slavery was a choice, yeah. Kanye, right?
Oh, my.
Right, right. Yeah, right. Lord. Exactly, yeah. And what Avakian has said on this question of choices and radical change, he said, look, people don't make choices in a vacuum. They do it in the context of social relations and they're meshed in at any time, and the options that they have within these relations, which are not of their own choosing. People come and they are confronted by those relations. They don't choose them. Mm. And that kept ringing in my head as I was watching this play. And then if you multiply that out to not just the bigger and what's happening to bigger, but and to his family, you just extend it out that way. But then also to black people time after time after time across the centuries and how much that has played. So I'd like you guys to talk about that a little bit.
Well, I can say that this play was written in 1940. I mean, the novel. We're in 2018. And it's still relevant. So that's telling. And all the modern day nuances that are embedded in the play with I Can't Breathe, Eric Gardner, Hands Up, Don't Shoot. All of these little nuances.
Crawl.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can't run, crawl. You know, that's Martin Luther King.
Yes.
This is a story that needs to be told right now. And because of the climate that America is in right now, it's so very relevant. And for me, when I first read it, I was like, it was eerily just daunting to me that this is still happening today. Because now we have social media and internet, you can see it. Before, when we was growing up, it happened in our neighborhoods and we heard about it, or we might read it in the newspaper, but now you see it happening everywhere. It's not a happenstance. This is embedded in American culture. And that's why he named it Native Son. Because I am a native of this country, but I don't have any of the rights. That's something that Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Medgar Evers, all of these leaders that we had that they fought for, are some of the same things that we're still fighting for today. It's just taking a new shape. So now we have mass incarceration, which is in modern day slavery. And when you look at those numbers, you see how disproportionate it is between blacks and whites or brown, the racial makeup. So in telling of this story, for me, it's personal. Because not only am I telling bigger story, I'm telling my story as a black man. Because, no, I didn't grow up under the same circumstances as bigger. I didn't have the same life experiences, or I didn't make those same choices that he's made. But I can relate and I can empathize, because somewhere down my lineage, my path, I'm pretty sure I have somebody that I know in my family that is a bigger Thomas. You probably have grown up around people that you know are bigger Thomases, as everyone. So anyone who comes to see this and comes to take part of this play, hopefully they will see some of themselves in bigger. And not just with what he's dealing with, but the hope. And the wanting to be something more than, to be bigger than what everybody else says you are.
Yeah, and to be able to be alive, which is a fundamental question. Now, Andy, I want to get into this with you too. And this is something that you wrote, and I just thought it'd be important in terms of people getting said. I think it was very heavy, this whole thing, right? So,
As she gets her spectacles on, I just wanted to add, talking about the fact that when people come to see this play, they get a certain something. I wanted to add that the Black Rat, as you had said, you wish you had a Black Rat yourself. I feel that it could kind of be exploded out to the fact that it's not only just about race, but with the Me Too movement going on now, everybody has the opportunity to empathize with every other kind of oppressed group if we could just have empathy and if we could just think outside of our own box with that, you know?
Although I would also add, though, that there really is a need for people to recognize what is happening to black people.
Sure, sure,
especially
definitely.
Especially with this Nazi we have in the White House. And, no, I'm sure. This is serious. You know?
But
this
what I recognize, yeah. I feel, though, it's very hard for people to get outside of their own plight a lot of times and see that we're all in the same struggle. Like when I went to the marches downtown, when Trump first got elected, everybody was in their own lane in the same march.
Right.
And we needed to cross-pollinate a little bit. So I feel like if people could just get out of their lane a little bit and empathize with other people, then we could all help each other.
I agree. And I think we have a responsibility to do that. So go ahead, Dean.
Empathy is everything. I just want to say that. And I think the fact that we go inside of Bigger's mind, there's a reason for that. If we can just lend ourselves to go inside, I think Nambi was brilliant in doing that.
Absolutely, yeah.
This is part of my director's note. It says, Skittles, I can't breathe. Philando, Brown, had my cell phone in my grandma's backyard. Oh no, not Bland. And the list goes on and on. My prayer, Lord, is that it would stop. This identification of this man, this black man, this woman as something other than human. I pray, Lord, it must stop.
See, I think that captures a lot in terms of what we're talking about with this play. When he wrote the book, it was, you know, it was something that was astounding and it was a controversial thing, but it was also something that was really, really moved people on a large scale. And I think to come back and realize, when I read that, I thought, damn, this is just what's happened over the last few years.
Right.
And we're talking about generation after generation after generation of this happening.
Well, how that came to me was in the middle of the night, those words specifically, and I just wrote them down. So they're divine because I'm not a poet.
You couldn't prove it to me. There's a comment from Irving Howe soon after the book was published, and he said, the day Native Son appeared, American culture was changed forever. It brought out into the open as no one ever had before the hatred, fear, and violence that have crippled and may yet destroy this culture. Look at today, the demonization and humanization of black people, especially with Trump. Think about that, and that's what we're going to go out with. And I want to thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my board offer today, Teddy Robinson, and all of my guests and each and every one of you for tuning in. And we'll be back again next week at the same time and same place with a different subject, although it'll have the same theme, all right?
Each other. Let our brothers know that we care.